investment, the options, get shot, go to jail, or get your ass kicked. The lawyers, the part, they are of the puzzle, the release, the warning, try not to get in trouble.
Jeff Chang is the author of the new book, Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. The greatest social divide in American life a half century ago and today. During that time, the U.S. has seen the most dramatic demographic and cultural shifts in its history, what can be called the colorization of America. But the same nation that elected its first black president on a wave of hope, another four-letter word besides race, is still plunged into endless culture wars. Jeff Chang's first book was the award-winning Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. He is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University. Again, the new book, Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. It is published by Picador, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this discussion and looking about the time period, especially even that term post-civil rights America?
Yeah, you know, what I wanted to try to do was to capture the last half century in U.S. history from the point of view of all the major changes that have occurred demographically. And culturally, I did a book. My first book was on hip hop and looking sort of at the impact of hip hop as well as the social kind of considerations in the context that hip hop came out of. And so for my next book, I wanted to look at the question of race, which I think hip hop in a lot of ways pushed to the forefront of the discussion, you know, during the 80s and 90s and the 2000s. And so I started doing a book looking at how the U.S. looked at the question of race after the peak of the civil rights movement. 1965 is a key moment. It was a moment that was the peak of the civil rights movement, the passage of major legislation, of course, the Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration and Nationality Act that transformed the demographics of the U.S. And also, you know, brought a lot of people of color into the mainstream of American life. And I just wanted to kind of look at the changes that have been wrought and sort of why we continue to sort of have these intense discussions, you know, around immigration, around Black Lives Matter, and that's what the book came to be about.
You write in the introduction of the book that in the United States of America, we still tend to begin each conversation about race as if it were new, from a willed presumption of what might be called racial innocence, as if we have lived nothing and learned nothing. We presume race and identity to be fixed, not subject to any past or any future, beyond interpretation and beyond change. How do we get to that point?
How do we get to change?
That mentality?
How do we get to this point? Yeah, to this particular mentality. You know, what's interesting, the first thing to say is that right now polls are showing that Americans are more concerned about race relations than at any time since 1992, which of course was the Los Angeles riots. And before that, the moment at which they were most concerned about civil rights and race relations was 1965. And so in between, there's these big troughs. And it seems in some ways as if we are living through a loop of history. You know, we sort of move forward, and then we forget all of the things that it took to move forward, and things kind of lapse. So let me give you a perfect example. 1965, there was a strong push to begin to desegregate the schools, and what we see is a number of different types of programs from which were all controversial, from busing to affirmative action, and so on and so forth, that get implemented over the course of the years, and this begins to change the way that people are interacting with each other. And what we have is for about a generation, there's desegregation going on in a very studious, methodical kind of way, often, again, controversial and fought against. And we get to a point where in 1989, we've reached sort of a peak of desegregation efforts. And this is not coincidentally the moment at which hip-hop actually becomes very, very popular. It's a way of talking about the U.S. That has gone through these cultural changes and that has in some ways moved forward from the civil rights movement, where people can openly, young people can openly be having these discussions about race and racism and histories of discrimination, and yet how also to be able to live together. Since that time, what we've seen is resegregation happening both in schools and across the board in housing and a growing gap in wealth between the different races. And so that brings us, I think, again, to the point that we have seen over the last 2 years. And the catalytic point, of course, has been the question of policing. But I think it goes to the backsliding that we've had around questions of race over these last years. And it goes to the question of why is it that we can't keep our eye focused on trying to undo legacies of past discrimination. And I think it does have to do with this notion of convincing ourselves that that we don't have to do anymore. We're in fact, once we start believing that, we are creating the seeds for another moment of crisis like the one that we're in now.
You start off the book by talking about comic strips and comic artists. And it's a really wonderful way of crystallizing the beginning of this post-civil rights America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to, because oftentimes, you know, talking about race can be so difficult and fraught, and the silence tells you as much as what's being said in our so-called quote-unquote race conversations, both you know, on an individual basis and in the race conversations that we're trying to have as communities, as a nation. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of do it as a lead-in, and also, of course, the story of this particular cartoonist, the first syndicated black cartoonist in the U.S., a guy named Maury Turner, was really close to me because Maury was a neighbor of mine in Berkeley. He passed away 2 years ago, and it was a way a tribute to the influence that he had on me as a young kid growing up in Honolulu, Hawaii, in a multicultural society, trying to look for just images of myself, even on the comics, you know, on the funny pages, and then finding it in his cartoon Wee Pals. And so his story was so important to me. But, you know, he began to be syndicated in 1965, and I was just sort of tripping out on the timing of it. You know, the 1965 was also the year of the Watts riots, and yet he had this cartoon in which, you know, it was sort of a multicultural Peanuts. It was as if he was trying to have these kids who are of all different kinds of backgrounds figure out how to live together. And it was really touching and poignant to me in thinking about all of the kinds of the polarizing and fractious kind of, you know, discussions that we have in the public space, that here he was as an artist trying to offer different visions of how we could live together, how we could create a really, truly desegregated society.
You have, we should note, panels and strips of Maurice throughout the book, which are really beautiful. When it comes to the time frames, because you look at this period of the past 50 years and you dissect it by different time frames, what were you looking for and how did you want to break it up?
That's a great question. I was looking for sort of the moments that we haven't necessarily talked about, but that seem to be pivotal. And of course, in some ways, I guess all books, you know, are autobiographical, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction. There's obviously an element of the author in it. And me personally, I came of age during the late 80s and the early 90s. I was a part of the first class at the University of California at Berkeley that was quote-unquote majority-minority, that was less than 50% white. And this is a time in which a lot of the kinds of things that we're seeing now in terms of debates about students on campuses and whether they are justified in protesting or not, whether they're overly sensitive or whether they're calling attention to issues that have not yet been resolved. These are the same kinds of fights that we were having during the 1980s. And I think that, you know, going back to the point that we were talking about at the very beginning of this, we've forgotten that we had these discussions back in the 1980s and the 1990s, and that they were kind of foreclosed. And here they are now with a new generation that's growing up even more segregated than our generation was, having exactly the same kinds of conversations about the need for diversity in the curriculum, about the need for spaces for folks who are not of the mainstream, who are of color, coming from different kinds of communities, to be able to come through and in that way integrate into what's happening on in the mainstream of society and on campus. All these kinds of questions we went through, and so I wanted to talk a lot about that particular period, and the arts were a really fertile type of way to be able to talk about that, because artists were pursuing these visions of segregation. And so in a lot of ways, the book is really about the way that artists offer us new visions of being able to get along and live together, and the kinds of struggles that they actually came up against. And so the bulk of the book looks at visual culture, at comics, at advertisements, at movies, at books, at contemporary art, and tries to get behind what the artists were doing, what they were thinking at the time, and the kind of resistance that they encountered. I think that we've arrived at a point where, of course, a lot has changed since 1965. And that's happened because of the artists pursuing these kinds of visions and making those kinds of visions mainstream. But at the same time, there's all of these questions that have not yet been resolved, and it's resulting in greater inequality. And we have to kind of get at that paradox.
You address in the book several times, you do it in the introduction and then throughout the book, both directly and indirectly, and that is the quote of Rodney King following the 1992 riots of, "Can we all get along?" And as you point out, we could not answer then, and we still cannot now. Will there be a point where we'll have an answer to that question?
I'm hopeful. I'm very, very hopeful. The book can, in some ways, seem pessimistic, but the thing that we can always count upon is that people will use their creativity to be able to try to express different kinds of ways of doing things. And so it's possible for us now to be able to turn on the TV or turn on the radio and be able to hear much more of a diversity of sound, of stories, than we would have even, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So I'm absolutely hopeful, and I think that we need to figure it out, because we are demographically, of course, moving to a place in which we will be a quote-unquote majority-minority country in another generation, in 2042. I tell my students, that I think along with the question of climate change, the question of how we get along, if we're all going to be minorities, how we become a new majority, that's the biggest question. Those are the two biggest questions that they'll have to resolve during their lifetimes.
Jeff Chang is the author of the new book, Who We Be, A Cultural History of Race in Post-Civil Rights America. The book is published by Picador. Jeff, it is a very—it's a beautiful book physically and a very beautifully written book literally, and I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Joe.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Who We Be by Jeff Chang. It's published by Picador. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.